We need to. We're gonna have. We're gonna bring the books, and
you're
I also have
recorded,
something.
So.
Something for us to look at. It's a longer article. We're not going to look at the whole article, just pieces of it. So we'll start with the Gemara.
So which page you want to start?
So we're according to what my assignment was to prepare was Kuf Tetzayin Amud Aleph. Yeah. So 116a.
A1, A2?
What? Yeah, so hold on a second. I think it's still a part of... It's going to be the bottom of A1.
Mishnah, yeah.
A1,
yeah, the bottom.
For the English.
Yeah.
If you need to do that,
Hebrew,
right.
What is,
so it's, I'm going to be in the Mishnah, right in the middle of the page. No. Mazogo lo kosheni. Yep. Kufdet Zion Amud Aleph. Like on, if you have like the gray bar, it's the top gray bar. It's like the last two lines in it.
Yeah,
okay, got it.
Ah, it's in the Mishnah. Okay.
Yeah, we're starting with the Mishnah. That's and basically what I, you know. This is what your rabbi told me I should do. I prepared the Mishnah and the Gemara just of that, so it's small. We'll see, you know, and we're four people, so we'll see how, you know, if we want the hour and a half, we have the hour and a half. If we want to make it a little shorter because we don't have anything else to say
we can
to
do it.
Longer. What?
We can do it longer.
You can always get involved in a conversation, right? Jay, you okay? You look like you need glasses.
I do, and I forgot them. I mean, I can follow along.
Okay.
I don't have to read out loud. No. I have a vision problem sometimes.
So put your cell phone and enlarge it.
That actually doesn't help. Thank you.
You know, like taking a picture, but it's enlarging it. Like a video, and it will be larger.
I need my vision. There's no help.
Okay.
Yes.
We good? All right. So we're in the Mishnah. Right. So... Mazgulo kos sheni, right? So they, you know, it's interesting, right? Because we don't do this practice anymore, right? I don't know if the rabbi spoke to you about, right, the way that wine in those days was very bitter and very concentrated, and they always needed to mix it with something, either a juice or a water or whatever. So this is what they're doing. They're preparing the wine, right? And, right, so the first part of the Seder, right, the first cup of wine, Kadesh, right? So if we think about it, Kadesh Urchatz was done, right? And now they're pouring or they're preparing, right? They're mixing the first, the second cup of wine. And what happens? And at this point, V'kan HaBen Sho'el Aviv, right? And over here, and at this point, the son asks the father, right? We don't know yet, but we know at least from this introduction, that the whole idea of the Haggadah or the Seder experience is going to be rooted in the question, right, which is not necessarily the case, right? That might have not been the whole tradition throughout the times, but at least as it lands in the Mishnah, this is how they're constructing it. The Im Ein Da'at B'Ven, right, and if the son doesn't have knowledge or the ability to learn, like he's challenged in whatever way we understand that, right? He's not able to, he doesn't have...
Oh, he's too young.
Well, but, right, but ain da'at, right, he doesn't have the ability, right? He could be too young. Yeah, we can do that. He's not able to ask the question. Whatever it is, either too young or doesn't have an ability, right? What happens there? Aviv milamdo, and the father, right, has to teach him, right? So we're learning, you know, yes, are you...
I was just going to say, doesn't it say in the Megillah, ask instead of Atar? To teach? When the child doesn't care to do the four questions, is that what you're saying? That the...
No, we're not there yet.
Okay.
I mean, eventually you're going to be there. I'm not going to be the one who brings you there, but that's not me. Right, and what does he teach him? And it's going to be like in quotes. This is what he teaches him. Manish tana halayla hazeh mikol halaylot, shebechol halaylot anu ochlim chametz umatzah, halayla hazeh kulo matzah. Do I need to translate that? Are we good? Does it sound familiar? A little bit, maybe. Shebechol halaylot anu ochlim sha'ar yirakot, halayla hazeh maror. Question number two. So far, everything seems to be the same as what we have in our hands today. Shebechol halaylot ono ochlim, basar tzali saluk umuvushal, halayla hazeh kulo tzali. Okay? Not in our four questions, but in the four questions of the Mishnaic times, and this is the text that I brought us, that we're going to look at a few texts that it's not exactly, you know, it comes to us by way of the tradition of one. Perhaps there was a Seder during the time of the Bet HaMikdash, right, in the time of the temple, and that they really, every day, they could eat anything, right? Sali, right, is roasted, right? Saluk is stewed, and umuvushal is cooked. So you can eat meat in any which way. But on Pesach, what are they talking about? Halayla hazeh kulot tzali. They're roasting the Pesach, the Karban Pesach, right? Again, post-destruction, that's not happening. And in our Haggadah, right, it doesn't appear. Right, it doesn't appear. It appears later on. It appears later on in a different Haggadah. But at least in the Mishnah and the Gemara, they're not misubim being yet. Right, which that's what we have, right, where they're not reclining yet, even though it's part of the practice, right? That's not the question that becomes part of it, at least in the Mishnah and the Gemara that I'm teaching you, right? Okay, everybody?
I have a question here. When I came in, I'm sorry to interrupt and to only hear part of it, but what I thought I heard was when in the Haggadah, it says that for the child who does not know how to ask a question, which I thought you were reading.
No, I'm not reading that.
Okay.
I'm reading Manish Tana Halayla Hazeh. So we're early, right? They just poured the second cup. We're getting ready. They just poured the second cup of wine. They just mixed the right? So we did Kadesh Urchatz. We're right before Magid. We're in that in-between.
Okay.
Are you with us?
I have the English, yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Great. I mean, do you want my Gemara? I mean, this is the rabbi's. Do you want this one? Because I printed it out.
All right. Yeah, because that translation is the one. Thank you.
Well, you don't need to use your request.
Yeah.
Hold on a second. Let's see if there's other things.
Okay, I was looking for hours.
Right. Well, I'm saying.
What is saluk again, you said?
Saluk is stewed.
Stewed.
And muvushal, obviously, is cooked. Right, so the way that... Let's see if I have... I'm just looking to see if I have any other copies.
Don't wait for me, because I'm
just...
I don't have the English, but I have Hebrew. Do you want... I mean... Okay. All right. Everybody, are we okay now?
Yeah.
I feel like we're resetting the table. Okay. Shebechol halaylot. Okay. Shebechol halaylot. And now we're going to do, right, you have things in parentheses. So I'm going to first read it, skipping the parentheses, and then I'll read it with the parentheses. Right. So Shebechol halaylot anu pa'amachat. Halayla hazesh defamim. So it's talking about the dipping, right? So in the varying texts that are in the parentheses are, Shebechol halaylot ein anu chayavim livatel afilu pam achat halayla hazesh defamim. Right, because they'll be, we'll talk a little bit about that too, they'll be varying taxes on, right, because the question would be is, what are you talking about when it says, anu pamachad halayla hazesh pamim, right, which means, like, literally, that we, something or other, one time, so the assumption is that we're dipping one time, and on this night, we're dipping twice, right, so even, right, so in the practice, the reality is they didn't necessarily dip at all, right? That's how it's come down to us, right? Ein anu matbilin, right? We don't even dip, afilu pa'amachat, even one time, halayla hazesh de pa'amim, right? On this night, we have two dippings. But in the time of the Mishnah and the Gemara, right, there was a practice of dipping vegetables into something, or the pat lechem, right, pitot, into hummus or whatever they were doing. So there was some type of practice that was brought down by the Greco-Roman banquet that infiltrated or adapted by the Jews as they, you know, adapted all sorts of things. Did you want to say something?
In the Agadah, they say that we must believe kazait. They put a measurement. Now, this is not inui, so why we need to measure how much we take?
I mean, in the Haggadot that I know, there is no measurement.
So, if we will go back when we started,
yeah,
like a few pages before, it's even there mentioned kazait.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I know for Yom Kippur, kazait, if you eat below...
Kazait, you're allowed to eat. You're allowed to
eat as much as you want.
Right. Or a cheekful. A cheekful.
No, I mean, as long as you take below the size of a zayit.
Yeah, but kazayit isn't an inui concept.
No, but my question here, because this is a real meal, yeah. Why they put in the Mishnah or in the Gemara at the time, and then in some Agadot, kazayit?
It has to be at least kazayit, not only kazayit.
If it's above, I have no problem.
It's above.
For
sure it's above, because we know that, right, when you're drinking wine, right, if you're, like, we'll call it, if you're really, like, if you're adhering to the halakha, you're drinking rov kos, right, most of the cup, and you're also drinking it, like, leaning, and you're drinking it without interruption, right? The same thing with matzah, right? When you make your kazayit of matzah, right, you can go to your local Jewish store and you can get even a board that you measure your minimum requirement for eating, and it's, you know, more than a board. It's more than, it's a shmura matzah full, you know, and again, you're eating it, you know, with intention, you know, so we're not, it's not inui at all. It's not the littlest amount. It's like
it's more than.
And maybe the kazayit, right, because the dipping, especially in the practice nowadays, is very, very different. I don't know how they dipped in those, you know, in the ancient times, right, but I know that depending on the community in which you are visiting, right, it's like dipping it into the maror and shaking it off, or even to the charoset, like, and shaking it off and just having it, like, you know, graze it by. You know, sometimes you go into communities and they put, you know, a lot on it. So it depends on, like, what's the vehicle in which you're eating, right? Which is a big thing when you study brachot, right? In the Masechet of Brachot, about what your intention is, right? When you make a bracha, is it like the pita that just happens to be the thing that carries your hummus, or is it the hummus that's the essential part of the meal? Right, so the rabbis kind of play around with what's the essential part of the meal. So again, in the kazayit, the idea is going to be what's the essential part of the meal. Right. Okay. So far, so good? Okay. So, right, ulefi da'ato, I got it, don't worry. Ulefi da'ato shel ben, right, and according to the, we'll call it the needs or the understanding or the knowledge base of the child, aviv melamdo, right? So in the case of the child who cannot ask the question, right, which is like the foreshadowing of those arba banim, the four children that you were referring to, right? In the case of the child who cannot ask the question, doesn't matter why he at the present time can't ask the question, right? Aviv Milamdo, it's Mechuyav on the father that the father teaches him, and this is what the, you know, it is engendered, and we'll look at the Gemara, and we have a little glimpse of a woman in our Gemara, which is great that I'm the woman rabbi teaching you about women in the Talmud, so that's always fun. Right, so what is he teaching him? Matchil beganut umisayem b'shevach. Right, we start the story, right, with disgrace or the bad stuff, right, which could be, you know, like traditionally, you know, my father was a wandering Aramean or however the, you know, the Haggadah translate that, or Avadim Hayinu, right, we were slaves, right, so that's kind of the bad stuff, and Misayem B'Shevach, and completes it, right, it ends it with Shevach, with praise, praising to God, right, that's why if you remember the Haggadah, and I don't know if we have any on if you remember, right, we end, right, like the traditional part of the Haggadah with, you know, Hallel Haggadol, right, which is the most praiseworthy, right, that's the, I think it's number, oh, I don't remember, 118, but it's the one that you say every Shabbat if you get to shul if you get to shul during Pesukei Dezimra. Right, so that ends up in the Haggadah, right? And not only that, what else does he do? He vidoresh, and he expounds. This is the whole, I think this is the whole meaning behind the Haggadah, is that people have to expound on it. It's not only reading it, but it's like thinking about, like, what's the essential part of it. And what does he doresh on? Me arami oved avi, Ad sheyigmor kol haparsha kulo, right from, and I happen to pull this off the shelf, Deuteronomy 26, starting in number five, and I'll read it in English. You shall then recite as follows before Lord your God. My father was a fugitive Aramean. He went down to Egypt with meager numbers and sojourned there. But there he became a great and very populous nation. This should sound very, very familiar in the Haggadah if you read it in Hebrew or in English. The Egyptians dealt harshly with us and oppressed us. They imposed heavy labor upon us. We cried to the Lord and the God of our fathers, and the Lord heard our plea and saw our plight and our misery and our oppression, and the Lord freed us from Egypt with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. Right, and if you remember, this is the piece of Torah that the rabbis expound on for the rest of the Magid, right? They say, what does it mean? My father was a wandering Aramean. What does it mean with an outstretched hand, right? Especially when it comes to, like, the Makot, right? On the, you know, in Egypt it was 10, but on the sea it was, you know, it was 250, and over there, right, it's like they go crazy with the numbers about how many, right, so, but this is what they're doing. And the interesting about this piece of Torah, this is when you brought Bikurim to the Beit HaMikdash. This is the verses, they're about from 5 to 12, that you read or you recited when you brought your first fruits to Jerusalem, when the Beit HaMikdash was standing. So there's like this interesting, right, it like Bikurim was born in Shavuot, but you started it at Pesach, so it kind of ties, if we think about, I always think about like kind of bridges or cycles, right, you have it starts at Pesach time, and it continues until Shavuot. So all through the Omer, the echo in the back of our minds are, oh, we're wandering, we're moving, we're going from oppression and slavery to freedom, and the eventual freedom is standing at Sinai and receiving the Ten Commandments and the Torah, and then eventually going into, right, Dayenu, if we think about Dayenu, right, the last of Dayenu is Beit HaBechira, right, the standing, right, that God, it would have been, the reality is it wouldn't have been enough, right, but it was enough for us to get to Jerusalem with the Beit HaMikdash. So just in terms of, like, thinking about arcs in tradition, this is a biggie. This you know, thing from the Torah and from Pesach to Shavuot is like almost like the same holiday, even though there are 49 days in between. It's almost an attached holiday. right? Because especially Shavuot is only 2 days, right? So one could say it's like atzeret, right? It's the extra piece that's attached to Pesach. And this is kind of the glue.
Could be that in ancient time they celebrate Shavuot for like 7 days. After the first day, they can come to Jerusalem later too.
I mean, the interesting thing is because you had to bring your bikurim, and you had to bring your karban chagiga, right, the holiday thing. So I'm going to say that, yeah, I think it was more than, I mean, we celebrate,
it's more than one day.
Right, we celebrate like Yontif as 1 day or 2 days, depending on where we're living. But I think it was a progression, until all the people could do everything, because you can't also sacrifice at night. It's not like the Karban Pesach where, you can sacrifice at night and eat it at night. A Chagigah needed to happen during the daytime. So if you're having even 100,000 people coming, right, which they had, according to the tradition, more than that, I don't know how you can do it in more than, a day, 2 days, a week. So it was it a yontif of that amount of time? I don't think so, but it was a time where people brought their first fruits and also their karban chagiga. Okay?
When they mention Arami Oved Avi, who they mention, you think, was the Avi? Jacob?
Well, that's what the rabbis, right? The rabbis in the Haggadah are wondering, is it Jacob? So you get to answer, right? Because the Torah doesn't tell us. It says Avi, right? So, it seems reasonable that it's Jacob, right? Because Jacob ends up in Egypt.
Correct.
Right?
But Jacob left the area of Aram Naharaim, the area which is the southern part of the Kinneret,
mm-hmm.
and the Jordan. That area is very fruitful. It's a lot of water. So for me, knowing this area in Israel, even when Israel had Batsoret,
mm-hmm.
this area was always green. So the real reason to go to Egypt wasn't starvation.
Well, according to the according to the Torah, there was a famine. They were
correct, So that means the Kinneret was dry. If this is correct, that means that the Kinneret was dry completely.
Or they weren't able to whatever. They weren't able to irrigate or grow or whatever from that region.
That's why I'm asking if the Avi is Jacob or maybe somebody else who was wondering. That's a different story.
So in the Haggadah, they ask that question, right? And who do they come up with? They come up with Lavan.
But Lavan wasn't Avi. Lavan was a goy.
Well, he was part of the tribe, but he was the uncle and the father-in-law.
The father-in-law, but even Abraham's father is not part of our fathers. So why Lavan Arami get such a good position here?
How's a good position? Arami Oved
Avi. It says Arami Oved Lavan was a fugitive. That's what it means here if you translate it correctly.
Not the way they
say. No, but that's what it's written.
They say Arami Oved Avi. They're saying he tried to kill.
Yeah, so they're the father and son relation, after two wives, But
if it is Lavan, right, they're giving him a place of, that a person, right, tried to kill our father, right? He tried to Oved, he tried to get him lost, right, in the simple, in just the reading of that. But I think that, this is what you're supposed to do, this is what the rabbis are encouraging in the Doresh, because it's not clear what all the pieces mean, right? And when it's not clear, right, the rabbis have a field day. That's what they do as Midrash, right? So that's what they're doing. They're saying, they're picking a text that's unclear, right? They know that you say it at the Bikurim, so it's like familiar, so people are, so people aren't struggling with what am I saying here, right? So they recognize it, and then they say Doresh on it, and they're going, they're saying, Who is the Avi? Is it Lavan? Is it Jacob? Is it something farther back? Right? Because if they were from Nahar Arayim, right? that, you know, it could have been any of them, right? That's the region that they were all from, right? That's where they start, right? So was it
this section, the wives of Jacob that were from there?
Well, also Terach was there, right? Abraham was originally from there.
He is from all.
Right, but he goes, but they...
Always in Iraq.
But I thought they moved...
That's on the other side of the crescent. This is where all is.
Right, but I'm just... Right, okay.
Yeah, okay.
All right, so... I'm trying to think. This is what I want to do with you. I want to read through the Gemara, and then we're going to look at the kind of the sources that I brought. So this way, you know, instead of like dividing it up into pieces, we'll just learn through, because the Gemara is not long. We'll learn through the Gemara, and then I'll bring out the sources, and we'll look at the several sources that, you know, just question like the whole piece of like how the Gemara comes into our hands. Okay? Does that make sense to everybody? All right. Great. All right. So, Gemara, Tanu Rabbanana, rabbis taught, right, which it means it's a braita, and it's, just in terms of importance, it parallels the Mishnah, right, in time. It parallels the Mishnah, so it's like it's a direct challenge as opposed to a challenge from a different generation, right? So, Chacham Bino Sha'alo. So if your son is a Chacham, he's the one who asked the question. Right, so they're going back, so the Gemara immediately goes back into the whole idea of question. Right, so that's what I want in the back of our mind. Right, is it about asking questions or is it about an alternative? And I'm not going to give you the giveaway to the alternative. You can think about what would be the alternative to asking questions. V'im eino chacham, and if the person who's the head of the household, who's saying the Haggadah, right, that's who im eino chacham, ishto sha'alto, right, the wife is the one who asks the question. So I want to, like, you know, say, right, if your son's not a wise guy, right, if he's not a chacham, and if the father is not, or the husband is not a chacham, but it doesn't have the ability, we go to the woman, which assumes what?
She's smart enough.
She's at the table, mm-hmm. Right? Because she's at the Seder table, right? She's at the table. She's an active participant. She has knowledge, right? She has something. She has something that the son or the husband might not have. Which is like an interesting kind of twist and orientation, because we don't think of her as has such a strong voice.
Is it saying that she asks the question or that she tells, that she gives the answer? I think only asks the question.
No, she asks. I didn't say anything about it. There's no answer. There's no answer yet. Sha'al means shin ayin aleph lamed, or the word means to ask. Only we're only in the asking. We're only in the asking stage, not the answering. So she asks the question. Because, right, according to at least this Gemara and this Mishnah, it's about asking the question, right? It's about who's able to ask the question. How do you ask the question? What's the if there's a formula, what's the formula for the question, right? Can you just ask a question? Right? Can you just ask a question? Do you have to ask the manishtana halayla hazem, mikola lelu, that? Or what happens if a child or anybody around the table says, you know, I have a question. Is that okay? So, all in the back of our mind. And imlav, and if she's not able to do it either, who shoel la'atzmo, right? So, he asks himself, right? So that's another level, right? So we have like a lot of levels, right? We have the son who's not a chacham, the head of the household who's not able to ask the question. We have the wife who has a possibility of asking the question, but she might not be able to ask it. So then he himself, right? So we're back to another level of him, right? We don't know who the him is, right? The one who can ask the question, right? Shoel atzmo. Va'afilu shnei talmidei chachamim yod'im behilchot ha-pesach shoalin ze lazeh. And even if you have two talmidei chachamim, two scholars who are sitting around the table, right, who know the halachot of Pesach, right? They know all of those, you know, the intricacies of Pesach. Even they are supposed to ask each other questions, right? So even if you know it, you still have to ask the question, right? So, before we go on, thoughts, ideas, right? Because this is, you know, because we have kind of gender and knowledge base, right? Layering. And then we have this whole idea of, right, because we're bringing up a new concept here, right? The Mishnah didn't bring this up, right, which is you have two Talmidei Chachamim, right, who know Hilchot HaPesach, and they also have to ask the question, right, which is another layer, right? The people who know, right, or who were in the know,
they should ask too.
They need to ask too. And even if they know the halachot,
to tell the story.
Ah, so that's right level thing, right? Is that, you know, so we have the question part of it, and then eventually, right, the telling of the story, or they're in parallel, or they're in a little bit of conflict, and we'll see when I pull out the sources, we'll see that, you know, it's not clear, like, what comes first, the question, the type of question, the script of the questions, and the telling of the story. Yeah.
They mentioned the wife.
Yes.
Why they don't mention a daughter?
I can't answer that. Right, I can't answer the question. I'm gonna insert, and if the daughter knows more than all of them, then she asks. Right, that would be my thing. Because the woman opens up that possibility, right? That
no, because in the Gemara there are places that the daughter is part of the conversation.
Right, but it's not here. Not here. It's son, husband. We'll call it father, son, wife. Talmidei Chachamim.
Am I right that the first that they mention is the son is the first to ask the question?
He gets the first right.
I think it's the B'chor, probably, no?
Hmm?
Is it the B'chor or is it the smallest one, the youngest?
No, it's just the son. That we have no youngest yet. Uh-huh. The youngest is introduced
later
on. I don't even know if it's introduced in the Gemara. You'll have
but,
to let me
so
know.
The primacy of the child asking. Question. So it really starts with this being four children is the number one on the list of asking the question. So I think that's very interesting because all of the ask questions, but they start with the child being the first one. I think the most important is to get this to the next generation, to the children.
It's to the children, right? It's called a ben. We don't know how old. I mean, it brings you up to, you know, the whole, you know, in our times where we have the youngest, right? It's, you know, this whole idea, which we'll get a little bit into that towards the bottom of the Gemara, right? It's to have the children, right? Is it, who's it for? Are we telling the story? Are we doing the Seder for the grown-ups around the table, for the children around the table? Who's, you know... Who is it for?
They're all included because when you have the two that know, you don't have any children around and still you do questions.
Right.
So it's the children first, but in all cases you begin with questioning. You could just tell the story, but this is integral to it, is that you tell the story because of the questions. So it's very interesting because not every religion and not every holiday necessitates questions, but the child does.
Right. I mean, and the whole idea of questions has to go, again, it has to go back to the Greco-Roman symposium that no matter what, and the question in the Greco-Roman symposium or the banquet, they always started because they always had, like, whatever, interesting conversations in the room. That was part of the requirements of coming together. Excuse me. Is that they asked questions, but not hard questions, right? They had to ask questions so that everybody could be included, right? An inclusive thing. And if you think about the Manish Tanah, it's pretty clear, right? Manish Tanah halayla hazem mikol halaylot, right? Shebachol halaylot anu oklim chametu matzot. Right away, right? Because we already did yachatz. Right, we already broke the matzah, we already exposed the matzah, we already played with the matzah, right? So we have that immediately in our sight. So you can ask, like, right, Are we eating, you know, bread? You know, pita? No, we're only eating matzah.
So how's the Brighton contradicting the Mishnah? Just going into more detail.
Right, I don't think, I think it's explicating the Mishnah.
Right, but usually when they bring it in, it's a contradiction.
I mean, the only way I would see it as a contradiction is that, you know, kind of it starts right where the Mishnah starts, V'kan HaBen, right, Shoel Aviv, and in the Braita, we have Chacham Beno, right? So we have a regular child versus the child who's the Chacham, which might be the spoiler alert to those four children that... I don't remember your name, I'm sorry. Bobby? That Bobby asked.
Well, it strikes me it's not a very far stretch because the Torah itself says, you shall teach your children.
Well,
it's a direct order. I mean, it comes with the highest authority.
Right, and we're going to, when I pass out the little things, the Michilta brings up Vihigadeta Luvincha, right, which ends up in the, right, which ends up after, like, a paragraph or two later, right, as... That's what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to teach your children. You're supposed to tell the story to your children for exactly those reasons of continuity, connection, and all of that.
Does anybody remember the Socratic method? You know, I know generally that it's a questioning method of learning, but how does this relate to the Socratic method? Because you're talking about the symposium and everything. Were those easy questions that Socrates asked, or were they very difficult philosophical questions that he posed?
I mean, I'm not an expert in that, you know, in that venue. But what I want to say is, at least in the symposium that everybody was invited to, at least the literature that I was reading, and you'll see it in the piece that I had photocopied for you, is that there was this idea that you asked a question. A simple question, so that everybody in their little, right, because everybody was leaning and everybody had like little pods of, you know, like threes and fours, you know, so that people could not be challenged, right? It wasn't about challenging the intellect, and maybe with Socrates it was about challenging the students to a certain intellectual rigor. It wasn't the Bet Midrash, right? It wasn't the rabbinic rigor of the Bet Midrash or of... you know, we'll say of Socrates or of the philosopher, but of what do people talk about, right? It's the icebreaker, right? Instead of saying, how are you, what's going on, it's posing like a question to everybody, right? So the host would get up and ask the question, which is very similar to this, right? We're starting to write already, what did you do? You had your first glass of wine, you had your you made your borei pri adama, you had your first dip, right? You broke the matzah, right? We talked about the matzah, right? This is the bread of affliction. And then comes the manshtana. So it's already, right? So you can already ask questions, right? I'm, you know, like, okay, the first kiddush wine, okay, we made kiddush. Not such a thing. We're dipping already. What do you mean we're dipping already? We don't dip. We're breaking matzah. We never break matzah and hide it for the afikomen. Ah, the children are going to go hunting for the afikomen, right? Or they're going to steal it, whatever your tradition is, right? And then they're going to start asking the questions.
You know, if you think of the formality of your teaching, what are the different methods of teaching? Well, there's memorization and there's questioning. And so... You know,
and there's kinesthetic learning, right? So this is kinesthetic. This is like, this is you're touching it and feeling it and eating it and seeing it. It's like, you know, the rabbis are our master pedagogues here.
John Dewey and Maria Montessori.
Well, it's the rabbis way, hundreds, hundreds of years before them.
Right. So, it is still very, very effective teaching tools for young children and for everybody is to participate, to do, and to question.
Good. All right, a little bit more. Hold on. Shtei Chachamim. Okay, so here we go again. Manish Tana Halayla Hazem Mikol HaLeilot Shebechol HaLeilot Anu Matpilim Pa'am Achat HaLayla Hazem Shtei Pa'amim. So this is, you know, so right away, this is the question that's kind of nagging at them, right? Not the matzah question, and not the basar tzli, and not the roasted meat, right? What's getting to them, right, because I think that they just experienced it, is about the dipping question, right? And how does the dipping thing all work here, right? So, manishtanah halayla hazeh, right, what's different than this night from all other nights? That all other nights, anu matbilin, pa'am echat, right? So at least they had a tradition of dipping one time at their meal, right? Probably pita in something. Halayla hazeh shtei pa'amin. On this night, we're going to dip twice. And we already dipped once, right? If they have a seder that like we have, right? The greens in the salt water. Right, and here comes the challenge. Matkif le rabba, atu kol yoma lo sagya, de lo matbila chadazmina. Okay, we're going to stop there. So a challenge is brought by Rabba, who said, what are you talking about? We don't dip any day of the week. We never dip. Atu koyama lo sagi de lo matbila chadazmina. Right, where are you talking, right, Gemara? Where do you know that we're dipping even one time? Not true. Right, ela amar Rabba, right, what Rabba really wants to say, or what he's bringing is, hachagetane, the Mishnah, what the Mishnah really wants to say is, shebechol halaylut ein anu chayavim, Livatel afilu pam, Livatel?
Litabel.
Thank you. Afilu pam achat halayla hazeh shtei pe'amim. Right. So that what the Mishnah really wants to say is that on all other nights we are not chayav, we are not obligated to dip even one time, but on this night we are obligated to dip twice. Right. So he wants to reread. Right, he wants to reread the Gemara, right, and the Mishnah, right? Because right, it's it, right? Because what does it say? It says, give me a second. Right, this is where all the parentheses are, right? Shebechol halaylot anu pa'am echat halayla hazeh shtei pe'amim. And you can see that right away in the Mishnah, they corrected in the parentheses. Rava's
concept.
Concept. His concept, right? His correction.
It's not in English; it's in the Hebrew. What do the parentheses indicate? That
it means that we are not obligated. So what it's bringing is what Rava's saying is that we're not obligated even one time.
I understand what it means, but what do the parentheses mean?
It means that it wasn't part of the original text. It was a different manuscript. It was a variant manuscript that's supported by the Braita in the Gemara. So if you were to look at the original manuscript, it wouldn't have it. And if it did have it, it would have it in parentheses or something to say that it comes from a variant text. But a text that seemingly supported in the Gemara and makes much more sense. Right? Because at least according to Rava, the practice was, what are you talking about? We don't dip. Even one time, but on this night of Pesach, we dip. All right? And now we're going to have another challenge. Mitkif la Rav Savra, chayuve le darduke, right? That Savra's saying, well, maybe it's about telling the children. You're obligated to tell the children. Darduke are children. So you're chayav to tell your children. He's saying, nah, that's not it either. He says, Ella amar Rav Savra, but Rav Savra is saying, Hachi Kitane, what the Mishnah really wants to teach us is, in anu matbilin afilu pamachat halayla hazeh shtei pamim. Sounds familiar? Sounds like what we have in the Haggadah, right? He's saying that you might have thought it was for the children, because, right, the children would have said, because I just saw them dip some type of green into salt water, what about the dipping? What about the dipping, Dad, Mom, right? And saying, it's not about that, but it's really about the changing of the text, or the right, the changing of the text to the text that we know. In Anu Matvilina Filu Pamachat Halayla Hazesh Te Pelmim. Right. We don't do it once during the year, except during the Seder, we do it twice. And the last little piece, right, Matchil Beginud Umasayem B'Shevach. We start with disgrace, or the low part, you know, the low lights, and we end with praises. My genut, what genut are you talking about? Right, Ravamar, Matchila, Ovdei Avodat Gilulim, Hayu Avotenu. Right, so according to Rav, what we start with is the story of our ancestors were idol worshippers, and Shmuel, Rav's trusted companion, says, Avadim Hayinu. And he says, what we start with is we were slaves. So not that our ancestors were idolaters, but that we were, you know, he locates us already in Egypt as opposed to in Canaan. Right, in the Middle East. Ambar le Rav Nachman. So Rav Nachman would say, right, you know, we're going to have a little story, which is always fun to have. Lidaru avodah demasik le mari lecherut. Okay, so he asked his own servant, right? He had a slave named Daru. And I love this, right? I love when the rabbis, like, turn to their, right, they have slaves, and, you know, not Jewish slaves, but non-Jewish slaves, right? So in the same piece of Gemara, we have children, women, and slaves, their own category of complication about obligation around, right, mitzvot, or what they're obligated to in the whole Jewish scene, right? He said, well, what would happen if you were released and your master gave you freedom, right? Mari lecherut, v'yahev le, and gave to him, disafra de hava, right? Silver and gold, my bai lemeimar le. What would you say to your master? What would you say to him? And he said, and Daru said, amar le, I would say to him, ba'e le odayui ulishavaihu. Okay, he would say to his master, right? Lahodot, Hebrew. Lahodot ulishavach, right? For thanksgiving and for praising, right? So that's what he would say, thank you, and he would praise his master for letting him free. Amarle, right? Immediately Rav Nachman said to him, Patran milomar manishtana. You just made us patur, right? You, like, broke the obligation of saying manishtana, all of those questions. Patach, he opened, right? He began va'amar avadim hayinu, right? Because he jumped ahead to the shevach, right? He needed to start the story at avadim hayinu.
By the way, this story with the slave repeats a few times in the Talmud, that on holidays and things, that you have a non-Jewish slave, that you need them for minyan.
Yeah, I know you, they come around, but
so it comes around all the time.
It's not setting him free. It's just saying, what would you do if you were set free?
Right.
I think it's a little cruel.
It's cruel, yeah.
Well, I think that he's trying. I mean, I don't know if it's cruel, but it's, like, interesting. He knows what it means to be enslaved, and he's saying, if you got your freedom, this is us. If you got your freedom, right, if you were enslaved and you got your freedom, so already they know, I'm telling the story of slavery to freedom, but I'm not there. I can close my eyes and maybe imagine it, but I don't really know it, right? Let me talk to somebody who knows it and see what, you know, if, like, what the tradition matches up with somebody's reality, right? And Daru said, I would praise my master. He would give me money, right, because that's what the Israelites got, right? They got gold and silver. They did good things with it, and not such good things with it, but they got right. They went to the, right, the Midrash says, right, they went to the their masters, and they got gold and silver and all sorts of other things, right, before they left Egypt. So he's saying, if I gave you, right, if your master, it was not even me. It was like, it was, a, you know, like a story. What happens if you would get your freedom?
That's theoretical for him. So I still think it's highly insensitive.
I have two questions. Question number one, what happened with a Hebrew slave on Pesach?
On Pesach, for a Hebrew slave? I mean, he was obligated to do the mitzvah of Pesach.
But he's a slave. So
no, no, but even, no, 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 but even the...
Tell him that you are free while he's a slave.
I mean, it's not a slave, it's an indentured, so it's a difference, right? You have slavery and you have indentured servants. Jews were indentured, right? Because it was only for 7 years, maximum of seven
and then
years.
You have it mitzvah.
Right, but then the tradition is very, very harsh with that person, right? They, the pierce,
okay.
Right, they pierce the
but
ear, that herd, whatever. I mean, you know, because it's easier to be a slave to whatever you're going to be a slave to. But he's obligated, right, it's
so
like Pesach.
So you're slave obligated to celebrate the Pesach the way we do it, like a free man, and praise that we are free,
mm-hmm.
although he's no, he knows that he's not.
I mean, because, I mean, if he chose not to be free, that's a whole other story, but... He's obligated for Karban Pesach, right? When they count to how many people are eating from the Karban Pesach, right? He has to be in the state of Tahora, right? Impurity, so he can eat from the Karban Pesach. He has to be counted as a person who's partaking in the Karban Pesach, and his master has to feed him Karban Pesach, matzah, moror, and everything else that is obligated for that. And the interesting thing is, the non-Jew in the community is obligated to the same thing. So Daru was circumcised, right? Because you had to have circumcision to be able to eat, to be able to eat from the Pesach. So they circumcised their male slaves as well.
Second question is, we were in Egypt many years before we became slaves. When we became Am Gadol Varav, then Pharaoh started to deal with us and made us slaves. So why when we start with the Gnut, we start with the Avadim, why we don't tell the whole story from the, because the first few hundred years, I don't know how many years, we were good guys there. We were connected to the kingdom.
So the story of Yosef,
we were rich, we were...
Right, so the question is, do you want to start with Avi, you know, Arami, you know?
The conflict of the source of the story.
No, but the thing is, it depends on where you want to start the story. If you want to start the story with either Lavan or Yaakov, then you have everything, including Yosef, into the beginning of the Exodus story. If you start with Avadim Hayinu, you're rejecting or you're skipping everything until they become slaves. So it depends on your point of entry.
So I have a biblical political question. So the decision to go to Egypt was a mistake. If we stay in Israel,
well,
the whole story will be different. So
Genesis says it's going to happen.
Right. In Brit Ben HaBetarim, God said to Abraham, they were going to be his descendants were going to be enslaved. He didn't tell us where, but he said that they were going to be enslaved.
So it was written.
It was written in the Torah. So it depends on your relationship with the Torah.
No, I just want to know where the cycle starts.
So the cycle already, one could say that the cycle starts at Brit Ben HaBetarim, mm-hmm. right, at the covenant of the pieces, when God says to Abraham, yes, your aunt, you're gonna be multiplied like the stars and the sand, but before you get there and before you inherit the land of Israel, the land of Canaan, and whatever boundaries God spoke in those times, which was changed, you know, several times until Deuteronomy into Joshua, but all of those pieces, right, all of those pieces are already starting with Abraham and that. So one could say it starts there because, right, the prophecy or God's words is 400 years. Although the Israelites were not 400 years in Egypt or in slavery, they were 210 years. So perhaps it started immediately after Brit Ben HaBetarim and then just continued on. 200 years, perhaps, in the land of Canaan, with all of the growth and prosperity, and then being in Egypt, right? And that's what Joseph says when he when he meets his brothers again. He already says, maybe I was put here for the reasons of saving you and making sure that you had Goshen and you had prosperity and you were going to become, you know, people of, you know, wealth and prominence in the land of Egypt. But he already says that, you know, this was perhaps the mission originally, the underlying mission, right? And then we have, you know, Vayakam Paro, the Lo Yadat Yosef, and then all of a sudden, right, translation, right, a new Pharaoh arose who did not know Joseph, and then the story starts with it, fearing, enslaving, and doing that, right? It all starts with fear. Yeah, wink, wink, 2017.
Right.
It's all about fear.
It's telling the story about gaining freedom. It's a perfect place to start.
No, I understand that, but, you know, sometimes people need to take responsibility why we were there.
So why don't we do just a little...
You see what I'm saying? It's why I'm here in America. I asked my question...
You asked that a lot.
I know, you are. You would take my citizenship. You know, just tell Trump that I'm here. Thank you. No, but do you understand
the
near?
I understand that there's a backstory to things.
Okay, don't read the whole thing. This is a gift. You can bring this. You can look at this. You can bring it to your Seder. Everything like that. But I want to just concentrate on a couple of things that I prepared for us to look at as we're thinking about all of this Pesach stuff. So not only are you cleaning and buying your food, you're also learning a little bit about Pesach. All right, so the first thing I want to do is, right, why begin with a question, right? So we're on page one. The idea that the Haggadah, that is the ritual midrashic retelling of the story, Exodus, begins with a question is found in the Mishnah that we just studied, right? So, English, they mixed him a second cup, and here the son asks his father. And if the son lacks the intelligence to ask, the father instructs him how different this night is from all other nights, right? So, that's question one, right? The Mishnah directs the Seder's discourse to begin with a question from the son. If the son is not intelligent enough to ask the question on his own, the father prompts the son to ask a question by reciting the Manishtana, which does not itself consist of question, but rather statement, means to elicit a question from the son who did not know how to ask on his own. Right, so Manishtana, what?
They don't go to the mother, they go to the...
The Mishnah doesn't go to the mother, the Gemara in the Braisa, or in the Braita, goes to the mother, not this is the Mishnah. The Mishnah is very clear, it's between father and son, right, the obligation, right, behind the scene is the father is obligated to talk to his son, talk to his child, right, if we want to make it right, so the family, right, so we want to egalitarianize it, right, it's the family unit, right, who's ever running the Seder, man or woman, is eliciting questions from the children, right, and if the children don't know how to ask or it's unclear for them, right, the father begins the questions to encourage, right. Because one could say, Manish Tana Halayla Hazemi Kol Halevot. Okay, so why is this night different? Right? So if you get to be a pedagogue with your child, right? So say, what's different? And they already are thinking about, oh, I already saw, right? You know, because you can prompt them in the beginning, watch what's different at the Seder table, right? And then it begins. And as your children, right, get older, you can even reflect, hopefully on your own experiences, right, that depending on the age of the children around the table, right, the maturity, or, you know, they're either leaving the table and goofing off or because they're disinterested, or if they're engaged, they're asking different questions. The five-year-old who's in, you know, who goes to either religious school or day school asks very, very different questions than the child who's 9 or 12 or 13 or 15, and, right, or... when your children become grown-ups, right, what questions just fly around the table, right? If you have a Seder of of adults, even if there are children of those adults, right? So all of that. So in contrast, I'm going to skip around, right? In contrast to the Mishnah, the other Tannaic sources emphasize the telling of the story or the study of halacha and not the asking of the question, right? And here's the thing that I wanted to think. This is Mechilta, the Mechilta of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, right, where it says exactly what we were talking about, so just kind of supporting your responses, right, in the tradition. V'higadet el avincha, right, you tell, right, the whole point is to tell your children, you shall tell your children, afal pi shelo shaylech, even if he didn't ask you. Ein li ela bizman sheyesh lo ben, bino leven atzmo, uvino leven acherim minayim. So, is it about the time that you, it's only about your son? What about the rest of the people, right? How do we learn the rest of the people who are around your table, right? Yourself, not your children, like who are the people, right? You have to identify who are your people around the table. Talmud lomar, v'higadet el avincha. So one approach is only your child, however you want to define that. Only your child, right? The second piece, though, is chayav adam, a person is obligated, la'asok, to engage behilchot ha-pesach, right, in the halachot of Pesach, kol ha-layla, right, all night long. So all of that, whatever else you're doing, you need to be talking about the halachot, which is great, which is all about the kazayit, because that's the halacha, right, how much do you have to do and how are you doing it? Afilu bino leven bino, afilu bino leven atzmo, afilu bino leven talmido. So when you're engaging in the conversation around halacha, everybody's included in that obligation. Right? So it's interesting that the Mechilta of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, right, is saying, v'higadet el avincha, I'm going to read it in a narrow way. It's only your child. Right, you're obligated to tell, which is your, right, your idea of continuity. Continuity happens through the parent to the child.
To be Talmudic, I didn't say only. He said only. I said first. That was the primacy.
Okay.
Make it exclusive.
Right, but he says only, right? But when it talks about halacha, then it's everybody. Then it's everybody. Not only that, we have an introduction of Levin Talmido, right? So the person who's around, right? So it's assuming that he has students. And his students are going, they're going to receive his teaching of the halachot, right? Which is a very rabbinic thing. You know, I would want to be very expansive in my interpretation and says v'higadeta means everybody around the table. You tell the story about anybody who will engage with you. And then the halachot of Pesach is everybody. It's much more an expanse, at least for me, it's a much more expansive experience. Right, so does somebody want to read just the bottom paragraph? So I don't have, it's English, I don't have to read everything.
According to the Mechilta, the Rabbi Shimon Ben Yochai, while beginning with a question may be preferable, the requirement to tell the story exists even without an opening question. In contrast, the Mishnah emphasizes that the Seder ritual must begin with a question and that if the son does not ask, the father must prompt him. In the Bavli, the centrality of telling the story or the study of halacha is replaced by the centrality of asking a question. We can see this clearly when we compare a Babylonian baraita with an earlier version of the same source from Tosefta Pasachim.
Okay, which that's what we're going to do right now, and they kind of line it up. So just to put it, you know, to articulate it, right, it's question asking versus storytelling. Right, that's right, the Mishnah. And at least the beginning of the Talmud, right, of the Gemara, is about the question, right, which is an interesting, right, thing. It's not, right, it's about prompting questions, asking questions, right? I mean, as a teacher myself, right, so I would always say, you know, the question, the answer is not so important, right? The question is way, way more important. The question is giving me a glimpse into what you're thinking about as opposed to the answer, which might be just regurgitating whatever information, you know, you might have gotten. So it's, you know, it's really essentially, at least for the Mishnah, is about the question, the form of the question, and for, at least for now, the Mechilta and then the Tosefta for the telling of the story, which the Haggadah brings those two together, right? The Haggadah produces something that has both, right? The Haggadah has the question and the centrality of the question and the telling of the story and the centrality of the telling of the story. So even if the Gemara and the Mishnah and the Tosefta and the Mechilta and even Rambam is talking about other, like they're having other pieces, but when the Haggadah comes together, it's all of those pieces. Right, because the entry, I think, needs to be multiple, right? Because some people respond really great to questions, and some people respond really great to telling the story, right? Because how do you, right? Chayav adam lirot et asmo, right? You have to, like, that's what I taught last year, if you remember, right? I don't know why I get Pesach. I guess it's because Shechter's dinners are always right before Pesach. So last year we looked at, you know, a person is obligated to see himself in the Passover story, right, as if he or she were in the Egypt. Right, that he came out of Egypt, which is about not necessarily the question piece of the program, but definitely the telling of the story piece of the program, right? So that's the reason why the Haggadah can say Chayav Adam, right, Lirot, to see yourself in that. Okay, so let's look at the Tosefta and the Bavli, right? So a person must engage in the laws of Pesach all night, even if it is just him and his son, even by himself, and even between him and his students, right? Chayav Adam la'asok b'hilchot ha-Pesach, kol ha-layla afilu b'no leven b'no, afilu b'no leven atzmo, afilu b'no leven talmido, which sounds very, very similar to the Mechilta that we just read, and it's in contrast to the Bavli that we read. Chacham b'no sha'alo, right? So if his son is wise, he asks him, v'im eino chacham, and if he, meaning the father, is not wise, his wife asks him, right? Ishto sha'alto, v'im lav, and if not, hu sho'el et atzmo, right? He asks himself, right? V'afilu shnei talmidei chachamim sheyodim v'hilchot ha-pesach sholim zeh. Right, and even if you have two sages or two chachamim who know all of the halachot, they also have to ask questions. So nobody is patur. Nobody is exempt.
Or you don't skip it. You must ask the question.
Right. So we're gonna skip ahead a little bit, and I think that's what the Rambam says. The Rambam's the one who kind of says you have to kore, right? You have to read the Manish Tana, right? You have to read the text. Obviously, you can ask questions and whatever, but there's something essential for the Rambam to, like, say literally the text of the Manish Tana. Right, so, again, this is about, right, the Tosefta states simply and practically that the obligation to learn the laws of Pesach exists no matter the company. Similarly, the above source from the Mechilta, the Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, emphasizes that one must tell the story of the Exodus, no matter the company. In the Bavli, the Tosefta'n Halacha has transformed it into a rhetorical requirement that a question must be asked at the Seder. This requirement must be fulfilled even if a person has to ask it himself.
Has to ask, like, to himself, right?
Right. He has to ask it, whatever, out loud. It's not an internal, right, and right. He's not. It's not an internal conversation. He's not like reading it to himself. It's a. He reads Manish Tana. What spoken words? Right, spoken words. And just the note 48. Note also the inclusion of his wife in the Bavli version. In the context of the study of the laws of Pesach, her appearance would have been surprising since women did not typically participate in the study house. However, she's clearly present at the Seder table, and hence, if he is not a sage, his wife asks him, which means that she is literate. That's the underlining, right? Because if it's about reciting or reading or whatever, she needs to be literate. And I remember teaching...
Well, she knows it by heart.
I mean, just that's the the recitation. It means that she has to be able to also have the capacity for memory, right? So that's what it's saying. But the interesting thing is we know that the women were literate, right? We know from, so if you ever have a chance of looking at the material from the Geniza, right, the Cairo Geniza, there are responses, there are questions written by women, right, that were found in the Geniza that asked the rabbi of the community about, you know, abusive by the husband, a child who's lazy, you know, whatever. But it's in her own writing, right? She's writing to the authorities about whatever family or financial situation she's in. So we know, at least from, you know, from the Geniza, that she is educated and she can write. And so I don't think that, you know, I'm not sure if it's exactly parallel, but we know that she, you know, I mean, it depends, you know, if we believe that Buria was, you know, was a woman, you know, that had rabbinic power, or Ima Shalom, right, the wife of Rabbi Ishmael. I mean, there are women who are present. You have Rabbi Akiva's wife, right? You have people, you have women who are present with their names in the Talmud. So even though it's called Ishto, the interesting thing, it's she's not called like Beto, right, which her house, which is the wink-wink version of when you read that in the Gemara, it's telling you that it's about the wife, right? Because she's the bayit, right? She's the house. She's the structure. But this is Ishto. This is like his wife, which is like a, almost like a personal, right? It's the mother. She's the wife. It's not that she's just the, whatever, the imagined structure of the family unit. Okay? So we'll go to Rambam, which is on 197. Right, and says, and they mix a cup of wine, and here the son asks, and the reader says, so who's that reader, right? How different this night is from all other nights, right? So, in Hebrew, the Omer HaKore, right, so somebody is literally by that time reading from the Haggadah, Manishtana HaLaila HaZeh Mikol HaLeilot. So the thing I wanted to point out, the Rambam skips, right, the phrase from the Mishnah, and if the son is not knowledgeable, blah, 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 since the Rambam holds that even if the son is knowledgeable and has asked a question, the Manish Tana text must still be recited. Right, that's where we get, you know, the recitation of the Manish Tana, right, that according to Rambam, even if you have, you know, 50 questions that are flying around the table, great, 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 you still have to read or recite Manish Tana HaLaila HaZeh Mikol HaLeilot Shebachol HaLeilot Anu Ochlim Chametzu Matzah HaLaila HaZeh Kulo Matzah, etc. And then by the time Rambam is, you have Maror, you have Matbilin Shtei Pa'amim, and you have the Misubin and Natsli Esh. Right, but Tzartzli. Right,
that. Do we have anything that are not scripted, you know, or brachot are scripted? Are there things that we are allowed to say without reading the words and without doing that? Because it seems to me that that's so easily diluted once you're not forced to say specific words and just kind of retell or whatever, that becomes lost or changed so easily. So don't we usually require reading of things and the exact words?
I mean, yeah, we read the whole, I mean, you know, at least Siddarim that have been the most serious and most long, right, have been, we read the whole, you know,
we read the whole,
you're supposed to read the whole Haggadah and then insert all sorts of conversations when, right, it's just, right, because you can, right, in the strictest kazayas form of the, you know, kazayit would be just reading the Haggadah. You are, you know, you do the rituals and you are patur, right? You have finished your yotze, you know, with your obligation. But the reality is because of the doresh piece and the shoel piece, right, and the higadita, right, those three pieces force you to ask questions and to tell stories and to see yourself in the story and what does it mean, you know, What would it mean like for you to, you know, like to recall the immigrant experience of you or your parents or your grandparents and things like that, especially since we're in this heightened immigrant experience, right? Again, forcing ourselves into, you know, thinking about where we came from and how we got here. I mean, you know, it's like this is a really, I mean, the reality is the telling of the story becomes relevant again. It's just not the recitation. It's like how we understand it in a relevant and meaningful way in our time, right?
So maybe the emphasis on the fact that it has to be that word is because usually children are doing it. So we don't even let the children make this question in their own words. We really want them to do the exact wording.
Well, I think we want both. But you know, I mean, I don't know, how old were your children when they said, just the first, right, that two-year-old, I'm just thinking about it, right, that two-year-old who just says, right, and they learned it in the tune, maybe, or whatever, right, it's like, oh, I'm crying, I'm whatever, right, Jay, right, I'm like speaking the truth, right, because it's very emotional, and then that two-year-old becomes the three-year-old who can say the first and second question, and by the time they're five, they're saying the four questions, and, you know, it's just about, you know, continuity and longevity and what happens, you know, because like I said before, the question of a five-year-old, right, because they're encouraged, right, and that's why I think we have those few steps before we get to the Manishtana, right, to say, what about that dipping? What about that breaking of the matzah? Right, what about that? Right, what about that? And then we have the Manishtana, and then it's the, whatever, the prescribed way of dealing with people, you know, just of the text, right, of the prescription of what we need to say, but it doesn't deny the plethora of questions that arise, you know, in your mind when you're preparing or reading the text, or depending on the Seder you go to. I mean, I've been to Seders that, you know, I get an email the week before. This is the question that you're, right, you're laughing, right? This is what we're going to, this is like kind of the framework. Bring your favorite midrash on XX, or tell a story about XX, or, right? You're shaking your head so you know that that those are experiences
people who lead Seders have to think about these kinds of things.
Right. So this is about that. And I want to just say, I just want to bring the Yerushalmi, because this piece also brings the Yerushalmi in, just to kind of, because I still have 6 minutes or so, right? And it's about, I'm going to say it's on page 199. Right, it says here, right, the Yerushalmi contains a different version of the question that attributes it to Bar Kapra, right, Eretz Yisrael. And this is what he says. And this is about the dipping piece. Shebachol ha-leilot anu matbilim oto im hapat, v'kan anu matbilim oto bifnei atzmo. So on all other nights, on all the nights, we dip. At least in Yerushalayim, in Eretz Yisrael, there was a practice of dipping pita, bread, in something, like I said, hummus, tahina, whatever, you're dipping. And on this night, right, because they're not having pita, obviously, on Pesach, and this night, here we dip it on its own, and there was this, right, you would take the lettuce, or the maror, and you would dip it in whatever by itself. There would be no pita. So that's the tradition of dipping your, what do you dip for adama? I've been to, from potatoes to radishes to parsley to anything else that has an adama, you know, attached to it. So that's what it's saying, right? It says here, according to the Rishami, this question is according to Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish, who holds that it's not necessary to dip the bitter herbs or lettuce twice. Right? In other words, according to the Rishami, Bar Kapra could not recite the Mishnah statement, tonight we dip twice, because he held that lettuce was dipped only once. However, this is the Rishami's explanation, and not necessarily its original meaning. It is not clear if Bar Kapra's version of the statement reflects a different custom or merely differently phrased. So just to say that the matbilin piece, you know, just like the Gemara, right, asks those, right, we have two, right, responses, two challenges, one by Rava and one by Rav Safra, that the dipping piece is not so clear, right, that eventually it comes to us in the dipping of twice and what those different traditions are in the Seder, but when we kind of unpack it and say, like, where are the origins, right, so the origins obviously are not clear. Everybody had their own tradition. Interestingly that, at least in this piece, there's no Hillel and Shammai. I wonder if Hillel and Shammai had their own versions of the experience. Yes, that there is several versions of what was dipped and how it was dipped. Yes, sir.
The source of the dipping. Why didn't serve it as a meal? Where the dipping concept itself came from?
So I think in reading, when you go home, if you want to read this article, if I'm correct, it's from the Greco-Roman.
So it's a copycatting, the way they started to serve their
like
meal.
It's their vorspeise, you know, it's the appetizer. It says right. Here, right, we shall briefly examine each question. Examine, wow, I sound like I'm from
it's
New
like
York.
It's like the Spain with the small dishes and all that.
Right, right. When relevant in later textual history, the first question reflects the Greco-Roman practice of dipping foods. I have not found any source that supports the notion that dipping was specifically done once. Indeed, as we explained from the Mishnah and the Tosefta, there seems to be a series of dippings was made with appetizers. Therefore, it seems preferable to understand on all other nights once to mean that we dip lettuce once during the meal as an appetizer. Lettuce was common, common appetizer in the Greco-Roman world, but is not part of the main course. What is different, that's what we call salad now. What is different about the Seder is that the lettuce is eaten both as an appetizer and later in the meal. Right, because we have it both, right? So it sounds like their tradition was they dip the lettuce in the salt water, dip one, and they took that same lettuce and dipped it in the maror and the charoset, dip two, right? The question therefore reflects the earlier custom of eating lettuce for both karpas and later as maror.
You said dip it in the maror and the charoset, so the lettuce would be the maror, and you're dipping the maror.
Right, because they use like bitter.
The chagas we have today, you can use that kind of lettuce.
Romaine. Romaine, because the romaine lettuce at the bottom, like the whiter part of it, is more bitter.
Endive? That's very, you know, spoon-like. I was thinking of switching to that.
Sounds good to me.
Is it bitter or is it sweet? Is
no,
it a bitter?
It's more bitter.
It's a bitter leaf? Yeah.
Yeah, but it's a smaller size.
Yes, I know. It looks like a little, like it looks like a, like you should put like a, what is it? It looks like peanut butter and raisins, like those little, like celery, but it looks like celery. It's not as hard as celery.
Right.
And people use celery as karpas as well.
The
maror in the charoset, right. And then you have the maror charoset in the hillel sandwich.
That's not part of the
dipping. No, that's part of that. That's why I think they're saying as it gets closer to the meal, it becomes part of the meal, right? That's the meal. And in the ancient times, you would have a piece of Pesach on it.
Who wrote this article?
Oh my gosh. I don't remember. I apologize.
Where'd you pull it from?
The rabbi and I spent some time looking.
Is this from the internet?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
I'm almost positive.
Okay.
I will ask the rabbi, because we did it in his computer.
Well,
yeah. I mean, take it. This is for you. You know, I figure that the last time I gave you some goodies to take home for your Seder. But yeah, great.
Thank you.
A minute before 9. Yesh koach, everybody. Beautiful.
Thank you very much. Chag Sameach.
Chag Sameach. Chag Kasher v'Sameach, as they say. Beautiful learning, guys. And I thank you for inviting me in.
Welcome. Next Pesach.
I'll see you next Pesach.
The calendar.